Good morning. I'm Diane Rowland, the Executive Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation, and I want to welcome you today to the Kaiser Family Foundation's Barbara Jordan Conference Center and to our briefing on maternity care, assessing the costs, and looking at consumer-driven health plans and their implications for maternity care. I think this briefing really is one that is at the center of women's health issues. We know that maternity care is one of the major events that is a common experience for many women. It's also their most significant expense, especially early in life, and for many, their first real encounter with our healthcare system and with our system of healthcare financing. I think for many younger people starting families, a high deductible health plan as being marketed today may be very, very attractive, especially because it has typically lower premiums, and the concept of a high deductible when you don't think you're going to need much health care may not be troubling. And many young families are low income, so the issue of cost to them is especially critical because they have many competing health needs, buying new homes, trying to pay off loans for school, trying to venture into new jobs that may not come with adequate health insurance benefits on the job, so that many may be enrolling in these high deductible plans with the concept that it's a good investment. Yet today I think we're going to see that when the maternity care issue arises, that may not have been the most prudent choice. I think that's why it's so important to understand both what it costs to have a child in America, how that cost can vary by what happens to you in the course of delivering your child, and how your health insurance coverage may or may not affect whether your family is financially stable at the end of that event and able to have the resources to adequately raise the young child that's just been brought to life. I'm delighted in this event to be able to partner with the March of Dimes, and I applaud their long leadership in promoting improved access to and better quality of maternity care to help assure that the children of America have a healthy start in life. And I particularly want to thank my friend, colleague, and commission member, Jennifer House, the president of the March of Dimes, who has been such a stellar leader in this struggle for so many years and who brings always her expertise and wisdom to the deliberations of our commission. And Colleen Sanofsky and the Thompson Healthcare Group, who participated with the March of Dimes in their study of the cost of having a baby. Today's briefing is really going to examine the cost of pregnancy and maternity care and the level of protection afforded by different models of health insurance coverage. All of the participants' bios are in your packet, so we will not spend time reviewing their stellar qualifications to be with us today. But we're going to begin with an overview first of how maternity care is currently financed. Alina Salganikov, our Vice President and Head of Women's Health Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation, is going to set off the discussion. Then we'll hear from Stella Chang, the Associate Director for Thompson Healthcare, who will present the findings that Thompson has conducted for the March of Dimes on the cost of having a baby. As you will hear, Thompson Healthcare has access to an amazingly rich database that allows us to learn about maternity costs both from the insurer and the employee perspective. Next, we'll turn to our colleague Karen Politz, the research professor at Georgetown University, who will present the findings of the Kaiser Commission study that she directed on the potential out-of-pocket costs women with consumer-driven health plans might experience when having a baby. The study with Karen Politz as the lead author and co-authors Mila Forman, Alina Salganikov, and Usha Ranji, I think provides a new perspective on how to view these new products on the market in terms of what their implications are for young families who are about to embrace maternity care but may not understand the financial consequences of some of the decisions they make in their choice of health coverage. After the formal presentation, we're going to turn the floor over to Jackie Judd, our Vice President and Senior Advisor for Communications at the Kaiser Family Foundation, and ask Jackie to moderate a discussion with the researchers as well as with two respondents, Tom Wilder, the Senior Regulatory Counsel at America's Health Insurance Plans, and Lisa Potez, a Principal at Health Policy Associates, who until recently was at the March of Dimes and, of course, has a distinguished career in both public policy and healthcare financing. Also joining us at the table just so that we can have one of the longest tables in the history of a Kaiser Foundation briefing is Mila Kaufman from Georgetown, who worked with Karen Politz on the consumer-driven study and has reviewed the details for the policies that were analyzed. Now I'd like to hand over this mic, which is now working, thank you, to Jennifer House, the president of the March of Dimes, and then we'll get on with our panel. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Diane, and thank you to all the members of the distinguished panel and those of you with an interest in this vital issue. We are going to unveil the cost of having a baby in America, but I think even more importantly, we're going to explore why is this data important and what does it mean to young families and what does it mean in terms of the implications for cost to the country, cost to families, and the necessity of improving birth outcomes in our country. So I think most of us know, but let me just remind of a couple of things. First of all, having a baby is the most common reason for a hospital stay in the United States. Pregnancy and childbirth-related conditions account for about 25% of all hospitalizations. And so you might say to yourself, well, it's kind of unusual. We wouldn't understand until this day the actual cost of maternity care. So in this report that you'll be hearing more about that was prepared for March of Dimes, Thompson Healthcare reveals that the cost for maternity care under private health coverage ranges from $7,700 to nearly $1,000, depending on the type of delivery. And the major distinction there is between vaginal delivery and C-section, and you'll hear more about that. And this is also for healthy deliveries. These are significant figures. Thompson Healthcare has done a wonderful job, a very proficient job in pulling this data together, and you'll hear more about the challenges involved in making sure that this was clean data and that these costs are presented in a very, very clear-cut way. So I think it's unusual that despite the fact that having a baby is the most common reason for a hospital stay, we rarely hear about prenatal care and childbirth in the context of the discussion about rising health care expenditures. And we believe that this is a missed opportunity and an important addition to the discussion. There's also been very little conversation, as you heard from Diane, about the impact of all this on families, on young families. So I really commend the Kaiser Family Foundation for bringing attention to the report that they're releasing today, which details the impact of maternity and infant care costs on families. So for both of these reports, there are three implications. Let me just summarize them very briefly, because they are of particular interest to the March of Dimes. First, we must all do a better job of making coverage available to all women. Given the cost to have a baby, the good news is that pregnancy is generally a well-insured event. Most families have employer-based coverage. And for others, through its relatively generous eligibility levels for pregnancy coverage, Medicaid provides a critical safety net in meeting the health care needs of pregnant women. In fact, Medicaid now insures about 40% of the births in the United States, according to the National Governors Association. But the safety net does not work for all low-income pregnant women. And one group that merits our immediate attention, low-income pregnant women aged 19 and older with family incomes too high to qualify for Medicaid, but who cannot afford access to private coverage. Karen Politz is going to show us in a few minutes for these uninsured women, the cost of even a healthy full-term pregnancy is simply unaffordable. I wanted to share with you that the March of Dimes is currently working with Senators Lincoln of Arkansas, Lugar of Indiana, Bingaman of New Mexico, Snow of Maine to give states, this is basically an amendment to the SCHIP program that would give states the option to enroll women 19 and older if these women meet the program's income requirements. The bill has broad bipartisan support. We are quite hopeful that when SCHIP is reauthorized this year, that that provision will be included, just to streamline the process and get these women who are not covered covered. Second implication, costs are prohibitive for everyone when there are major complications in a pregnancy, such as preterm birth. For the self-insured employers, a 2004 Thompson study found that healthcare costs to employers for the first year of a preemie's life, those costs were 15 times higher than for a full-term delivery. For the consumer-directed health plans, you'll hear more from Karen about that in just a moment. For the nation's economy, the Institute of Medicine just issued a report in the last few months documenting for the first time, it's excellent work in health economics, that the annual cost to the nation for premature birth is $26 billion a year. And that covered kids up through age 7 who suffer the consequences of preterm birth. It's a quiet epidemic, and just to size it for you, 520,000 babies out of an annual birth cohort of 4 million are born preterm in the United States. Rates have been rising since 1981. That's for another day, but a very, very serious problem. Third area, we have real work to do to make sure that prenatal care is considered to be a preventive health benefit under the consumer-directed plans. Why is this important? It's important. In fact, we were actually troubled by the finding that prenatal care was not considered preventive because the costs are much more for prenatal care, in fact, probably prohibitive for some families. There are many examples, again, for another day, of risk reduction that can be accomplished, for example, through counseling during prenatal care, but only probably will be accessed by women. If this is a preventive health benefit and they do not have to pay out of pocket to do risk reduction in the early stages of pregnancy especially. So these reports document that the aggregate cost of pregnancy is significant for families. It's why we need to all work together to find ways to make health coverage, particularly for maternity care, accessible, affordable, and it's why it's so important that we work for the day when the first question asked when the baby comes home from the hospital is, isn't our baby beautiful, honey? Not how are we going to pay this monster hospital bill? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jennifer, and thank you, Diane. It's great to be here this morning. This event has been a long time coming, and before I get started, I really want to extend a personal thanks to Colleen Sanofsky at the March of Dimes and Lisa Potetz, who was Lisa and I concocted this collaboration many years ago, and so it's really terrific to see us all together to learn about these studies. I'd also like to thank Karen and Mila for really doing an outstanding job with this project, and to finally my colleague Usha Runji, who's always been so involved and committed in helping organize these events. We have a lot of ground to cover today, so I'm going to just get us started here. As we heard earlier, obstetric care is the leading reason for hospitalization for women of reproductive age. Since we're the Kaiser Family Foundation, we couldn't resist sharing a graphic with you about how the costs are distributed. For women, it accounts for 60% of hospitalizations for women of reproductive age and nearly a quarter of all hospitalizations in the United States. And of the over 4.1 million deliveries in the United States, nearly 3 in 10 are cesarean section. I'm going to talk about that in just a minute. But it's also important to note that one-third of all births are the result of an unintended or unplanned pregnancy. This is, for many families, it's not necessarily an unwelcome event, but it's an event that they were not planning on. So in terms of thinking about what their costs are going to be in the coming year, this may not be a consideration for families. And unfortunately, about one-third of births have some type of complications. While some are mild, some are quite serious and can jeopardize the health and well-being of the infant and of the mother. In fact, 12%, as we heard, of all births are preterm births, which is a statistic that the March of Dimes has long been working on trying to reduce. And 8% of births are low birth weight. That's births under 2,500 grams. And 3 to 6% of women have gestational diabetes, which also has very significant risks to the mother and the baby, and is a condition for which sometimes a woman is otherwise healthy. She would not have known that she was going to be at risk for gestational diabetes before she got pregnant. Any complication has cost implications. And many of these complications occur to women, as I said, who are otherwise healthy. One of the most important trends in childbirth has been the rapid growth in C-section rates. This uptick has happened, as you can see, quite significantly in the past 10 years and is in response to a number of factors, including now higher rates of multiple births and now studies that have found higher complication rates in delivery among women who have attempted to have a vaginal birth after a C-section, or VBAC rates. As a result, now nearly one-third of births in this country have a surgical intervention, which, aside from the health and recovery consequences, also has significant cost implications for insurers, employers, and families. And although women have been having babies for as long as there have been people around, the way childbirth clearly has been managed has been changing considerably, and I'm not going to go into all the details of the history of childbirth practices, but it is important to note that even within the past decade or so, there have been many changes in clinical practice that have health and cost implications. In the prenatal period now, there have been great advances in genetic screening and also in imaging through sonograms now that even allow us to have 3D sonograms that give us a much better sense of the potential health risks, and in some cases allow us to do early interventions to preserve the health of the fetus. As mentioned earlier, we've also seen growth in the preterm birth rates, but also a higher rate of survival for these very premature and tiny infants, but also at a very high cost. And similarly, medical advances in fertility treatment have resulted in higher rates of multiple births, again, often by C-section and preterm births. And in the postpartum period, now almost every year, we have new screening tests that allow us to make early, in some cases, life-saving diagnoses for newborns. So how do we pay for all of this? As we heard earlier, that depends. That depends on a woman's insurance coverage, and it also depends on her income. Medicaid, as we heard, pays for nearly 40% of all births. But in order to qualify for Medicaid, you must be pregnant and low income. The federal floor is at 133% of poverty. Many states can, and many states do go higher, usually as high as 200% of poverty. Some go a little bit higher. In poorer states, over half of all births are covered by Medicaid. But eligibility for this group of women is limited to pregnancy-related services and ends 60 days postpartum, unless the mom is very poor and then subsequently qualifies for Medicaid. For the infant, the coverage is extended for the full year. Most individuals with employer-sponsored coverage have maternity coverage. This is a mandated benefit under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act for all employers with 15 or more employees. This happened because, like we've heard more recently with contraceptive coverage, there were cases where insurers were not covering maternity care, so that this was a very important protection for women. While this benefit is mandated, there is significant variation, and as we're going to hear more, in the scope of coverage and in the level of out-of-pocket costs families with employer-sponsored coverage face. This is the case with traditional insurance as well as with the consumer-driven health plans. In the individual market, coverage of pregnancy-related care is much more limited. There are a handful of states, I think about 11, that require plans, individual policies to cover maternity care. But for the most part, this care is explicitly excluded, or families need to buy a rider to have this coverage, or there may be caps or waiting periods for the coverage. And finally, for uninsured women, if they don't qualify for Medicaid, as we heard earlier, there are really very few options. Some states do have subsidized plans, but that's very limited, depends on where you live, and in some cases those programs are capped. We've seen some of the discount cards marketed, and all you have to do is type in maternity care in Google, and you see all these discount card offers appear, but in fact that is not insurance coverage and is not really meaningful assistance to women who are facing the type of bills that we're going to see about in a minute. So you can see here, this is the insurance coverage and income distribution of women of reproductive care. Women of reproductive age. As you can see here, most of this group has employer-sponsored coverage. 6% have individual coverage, and for this group, they really don't have maternity coverage. That should be something that is, I think, people aren't aware of very much. And I've actually got fielded calls about this, and it does not cover maternity care. And 11% have Medicaid, although many of these women will then requalify for Medicaid, because you can see here, if you look at the income distribution, about 40% are low income. Those are women who have incomes below around $32,000 a year for a family of three. And so those are very important considerations when you look at what out-of-pocket costs families might face. And in response to concerns about costs, we've seen increasing attention to consumer-driven health plans. These plans can be very attractive for low-income families. They have lower premiums, and they're often accompanied by a health savings account, which has tax savings for the family. They do, however, have considerably higher deductible levels than other traditional employer insurers, and they shift more of the responsibility of the costs onto the consumer. Proponents believe that this is going to make consumers more cost-conscious and promote more prudent healthcare choices. So in the past years we've seen here, these are actually, there's about 3.2 million, I think, are the newest numbers from AHIP that are enrolled in consumer-driven health plans. These are covered lives, but this is nice because it really shows you the trend and the growth in the enrollment. Some research is beginning to emerge about consumer experiences with these models, but actually the body of evidence is actually quite small. So part of what we wanted to do is to try to get a better understanding with the study that Karen has directed on what this might mean for maternity care. So today, we hope to answer some questions here. We hope to know, and Stella Chang is going to share her analysis on what it costs to have a baby, who pays, and where the dollars go. Then we're going to turn to Karen, who's going to provide an overview of how health insurance covers maternity care. And then we're going to take a closer look at how high-deductible consumer-driven health plans differ from private insurers. Traditional insurance policies and how that might affect family costs. So I'm going to turn over now to Stella.
Thank you, Alina. I would like to first off thank the Kaiser Family Foundation and the March of Dimes for giving Thompson Healthcare this opportunity for this analysis and also for the opportunity for us to participate in this important discussion. And people see me over this podium? Okay. You know, as long as you can hear me and see my slides, that's key for me. So The reason why, we got involved in this study and, we have this database that we thought would be useful is that, there is a need to estimate the cost of associated with having a baby in the United States. And on the slide that you see in front of you, we've listed a couple of compelling reasons why that is. Approximately 4 million births occur in the U.S. every year. And pregnancy and childbirth make up about, a quarter of all the hospitalizations in the United States. Yet, as Alina has alluded to a little bit earlier, there have been surprisingly, sparse data about just the cost of having a baby in the U.S. And in particular, what is the cost and what is the impact of that cost when you start segregating populations by their insurance coverage, whether that is the publicly insured, the uninsured, or even those with private insurance? And in particular, what is the impact of the 54% of Americans who have employer-sponsored insurance? So what we wanted to do was that we have this database of 10 million individuals in employer-sponsored insurance. And what we did was we provided a cross-sectional snapshot of what these costs look like in 2004. So the database that I alluded to a few seconds ago is the MarketScan Commercial Claims and Encounters database. I'm going to very quickly go over the methods and just, discuss how that impacts the results that I will also present. And the MarketScan Commercial Claims Encounters is a national database. We have coverage of every state in the U.S., and it includes about 10 million employees during the study period of 2004. These are all individuals who are covered by large self-insured employers, and we have in this database all of the paid and adjudicated claims for all of the covered services. And so this includes the inpatient and outpatient as well as prescription drug claims. We identified all the births in 2004, and included in the study are only the live births. So what this means is that we have all the normal deliveries, regardless of the method of delivery, And we kept all the births as long as it resulted in a live birth. So what would be missing from this analysis are, you know, the stillborn babies, and, you know, which would represent a substantially higher cost, as you can imagine. In addition to that, we focused only on those with fee-for-service insurance coverage. So these are women who have coverage under traditional indemnity plans, also for under PPOs or point-of-service plans. And the reason why we did not include women under capitated plans is that when you look at a claims database and you look at the claims, the payment information is often not, you know, reflective of the actual service rendered, in that you cannot really tie a payment with a service when a provider is paid on a capitated basis. So for the purposes of quantifying the cost of maternity care, we focused on a one-year period around the birth, and we further broke that out into the prenatal period, which is 9 months prior to delivery, also 3 months postpartum, and so that makes up the 12 months, and which also includes the delivery costs. And the focus of this study, which if any of you are familiar with our earlier preterm low birth weight study, is that the contrast is that this one focuses only on the maternity-related services. We wanted to quantify what is the cost of having a baby for the family, and in particular, what are the costs due to the services that are rendered to the mother. And so with this, it includes all the medical, laboratory, radiology claims. We also included the drug costs. The difference between our drug cost estimates and the other medical services is that for the medical services, we did break out what was maternity related using, you know, the procedure codes that we felt were relevant for maternity care. And in the absence of those procedure codes, we looked for a diagnosis that was pregnancy or pregnancy related. All of the costs that we report and that we capture are, you know, included in that are the provider charges, as well as the total payments. And this is what I'm going to focus on when I talk about the cost. We also had the ability to break that out to what the health plan, which in our population is basically the employer, what are the costs to the employer / health plan, and also what are the out-of-pocket costs for the mother and the family. And then finally, you know, because there is such a great cost differential that we found in previous studies, we broke out these costs by vaginal births and C-section deliveries. So overall, in our database, we identified about 43,000 live births in 2004. Now, there were certainly more, and, you know, out of the 10 million individuals that we have. The reason why we came down to this final number was that, you know, we only included women who had enrollment, so we had the opportunity to capture all of their costs during this one-year period. And approximately one-third of those deliveries were C-section, so that is, you know, very consistent with reports by AHRQ and other sources. And overall, the average cost of having a baby was $8,802. Out of those costs for our employer-sponsored population, the health plans covered a majority of that, $8,236, with out-of-pocket expenses averaging $483. So you can see that at this point in time, there is, you know, the health plans are very broad in terms of what they're covering for maternity-related care, you know, whether that is for the delivery, prenatal, or postpartum. So what I have up here now are just the costs that are broken out by the type of delivery. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, you do see a substantial cost differential between a C-section delivery and a vaginal delivery. In terms of the proportion of costs that are paid out of pocket, they're relatively close. And, you know, one of the nice things about our database is that we do have the ability to break out these costs by the types of service, which is what you see up here. And so you can see, you know, whether you're talking about C-section or vaginal, approximately half of all the costs are paid out for facility fees. And what this basically means are the fees that are associated with the hospitalization for delivery. It's a greater proportion for C-section deliveries, and that is really driven by the longer lengths of stays and the complications that are, you know, often associated with these types of deliveries. But the professional service fees also make up a pretty significant portion of the overall costs. And so these included in these are, you know, not only the cost for that a physician is going to get paid for the actual delivery, but a lot of that is also connected to just the prenatal care that is involved, you know, prior to a delivery. And then, you know, finally, you do have the other components, the radiology and imaging, such as sonograms, also, you know, lab tests, blood tests, and so forth. And then making up a smaller portion are the outpatient drugs. Another thing that we'd found was that there are some regional variations between, you know, the four regions that I have up here in terms of the cost of having a baby. And these variations are pretty consistent when you compare vaginal deliveries with C-section, in that you find that it's most expensive in the Northeast and the least expensive in the South. And again, when you sort of step back and you look at overall healthcare costs, this pattern, you know, remains pretty consistent in our database. So what we concluded from this analysis is that, you know, the health services related to having a baby represents a substantial cost for plans, for employers, and for families. And, you know, as was mentioned earlier, for women of childbearing age, this often represents the highest healthcare costs that, you know, they will encounter at that moment in time. And, you know, as you saw in the pie charts earlier, the maternity costs often extend beyond the hospitalization in that, you know, you have your related prenatal care. A lot of that could be office visits, but also ancillary services like lab and radiology also contribute to that. And among women with employer-sponsored insurance, as of this point in time, health plans did cover the majority of the cost. However, you know, as the technology evolves and just as importantly as benefit plan design and health coverage changes in this country, you know, we feel that additional analysis will be required to understand their effect. But, you know, hopefully we've at least provided you with, you know, a baseline assessment of, you know, what it currently costs. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Karen Palitz. My biography does not mention that I'm a mother of two, so I'm happy to be here talking about this topic and happy to be speaking on behalf of my colleague, Mila Kaufman, who was my partner in this project at Georgetown. The question that we were posed with was, how would consumer-driven health plans cover maternity care, and what would they mean to families who were contemplating a pregnancy? And as you've heard, consumer-driven health plans seem to be a growing trend in the insurance market. And compared to the health insurance, that traditional health insurance that I think most people are still accustomed to, consumer-driven health plans, or CDHPs, do require higher cost sharing, but in return, they promise some benefits to consumers, including lower premiums and other advantages. In particular, as we looked at the way that these plans are marketed, there is a great emphasis, and even the name of the product implies, on consumer control over their health care. In return for taking on a greater share of the cost burden, consumers are promised greater choice in providers, freedom from health insurance oversight. In short, putting consumers in the driver's seat is the promised benefit here. And this slide and other examples in our report just give you some examples of the kinds of advantages that CDHPs offer in their marketing. So how, in general, before we talk too much more about consumer-driven health plans, is maternity care covered by insurance? And you've heard some of this already. There are a couple of important questions to answer. The general answer is it depends. The first question is whether maternity care is a covered benefit under the policy. It almost always is under employer-sponsored policies, but it's much less commonly covered under policies that people purchase individually in the individual market. The next question that you would need to look at in terms of how is maternity care covered by insurance would be the cost sharing. So what are the annual deductibles that, you know, the out-of-pocket costs that you need to cover before your insurance company or insurance plan begins to reimburse costs? Also, co-insurance and co-pays, additional cost sharing that may occur after you've satisfied the deductible. And is there an out-of-pocket maximum on your cost sharing in a year? And if so, what is that? You also need to look at the provider network. Many plans cover a higher degree of costs if you receive care from hospitals and doctors and other providers within the health plans network. And then you need to look at exclusions. So, and this is true of, these questions are important to ask of all health plans, not just consumer-driven health plans. Just a show of hands here, how many of you in this room have health insurance? How many of you have ever read your policy? Oh, I see hands. I'm impressed. That's a, how about up here? All right. most people just read the summary, and then they kind of assume that they have a general idea of what their insurance covers. But for anyone who's ever made a claim, I think you begin to appreciate that it can be a little more complicated than what the summary implies. For this project, what we did, and when I say we, I mean Mila. My colleague Mila Kaufman is an attorney and a former insurance regulator herself. We gathered about a dozen health insurance policies, and she read them. They're all about 100 pages or more, and there is fine print, and you need to be a lawyer to read them, and they're pretty complicated. So, and what we found in looking at all of these policies was there was a lot of variation across the policies, even in policies that might seem to be similar just based on looking at the summary. So, for example, if you look at two policies that each have a $1,000 deductible, you might think, well, those are about the same, but under one, not all of your covered costs might count toward the deductible, whereas under another, more costs would. And the same for the out-of-pocket maximum. More or less of your cost sharing, your four covered benefits might or might not cover or might count in different ways toward the out-of-pocket maximum. And there are other kinds of, you know, rules that you need to satisfy before care will actually be covered. For maternity care, one key issue that we noticed was when family coverage begins. When I was pregnant with my first baby, my husband and I were each covered under our own policies at work, which a lot of young couples do it that way. And then after Daniel was born, we converted to family coverage. And there's kind of this question, well, when exactly does the family coverage start and the family level of cost sharing begin, because it's usually twice as high as the level for a single person. We looked for an answer to when does family coverage begin in these policies. It was very hard to find. And we even needed to go back and interview people who worked for the insurance companies whose policies we examine, and the rules really do vary. Sometimes it's when the baby's born. Sometimes it's when you elect coverage. Sometimes it's the first pay period. After you elect coverage, it's very different, but it really matters. Coverage of pregnancy complications was another issue. This is most important when you have an individual policy that doesn't cover routine maternity care but will cover complications of pregnancy. Finding out what complications are covered and when they're covered, very difficult to do, and the contract language was not helpful in any policy, traditional or consumer-driven health plans that we looked at. And so, again, we had to go back to plan officials and interview medical directors and give them some scenarios of medical complications and say, would these be covered? And the answer was, it's usually, you know, kind of determined on a case-by-case basis, or it's often determined that way. To underscore what a challenge it can be to understand how your health insurance works, one of the policies we looked at actually had printed on the cover in big letters in boldface type, this agreement should be read and reread in its entirety. And at the end of this project, I believe that. and that's just generally true of health insurance. So what could it cost you to have a baby? Well, that depends. The number that Stella gave you was an average, but in fact, what it would cost any given family to have a baby could really vary. Certainly an important thing is sort of how is the pregnancy progressing clinically and are there complications? The timing of the pregnancy will also matter in terms of what you pay out of pocket under your health insurance. The odds are that a 9-month pregnancy is going to fall across two calendar years and possibly two plan years. So when you look at your deductible and your out-of-pocket limit, those are all for a calendar year. So you could hit those twice in the course of a pregnancy, and that's going to matter. Whether your insurance covers and sort of all the things that we talked about will also matter for what it could cost you to have a baby. And then finally, just a word about billed and approved charges. Stella's slides were looking at approved charges. As many of you have probably noticed, if you filed a claim, the bill that comes in from the doctor or the hospital is one amount, and then the amount that your insurance company recognizes as reasonable is often a different, lower amount. And whether you are paying billed charges or approved charges or a percentage of billed or approved charges also has to do with features in your health insurance coverage and how it works. Okay, so what are these consumer-driven health plans? They also vary, just like other kinds of insurance policy varies. A common feature is that they have high cost sharing. Under traditional health insurance sponsored by employers, according to research from the Kaiser Family Foundation, the average annual deductible per person is about $300. And the average out-of-pocket limit, or $600 for a family, and the average out-of-pocket limit, including the deductible that you would be liable for, is about $2,000 for an individual, $4,000 for a family. But for consumer-driven health plans, these amounts can be much higher. So we looked at policies that had an annual deductible of $1,000 per person, $5,000 per person, double those amounts for family coverage, and then out-of-pocket limits that could be $5,000 per person, $10,000 for family, up to $15,000 for family, and we even saw some policies where there weren't limits. The notion of these, you know, the thought behind this higher cost sharing in these CDHPs is that it will promote more careful, more prudent use of healthcare services by individuals. They'll go out and do some research to try to, you know, keep costs down on their own. And in return, premiums tend to be lower on average, about 24% lower for single coverage, 31% lower for family coverage. Some of these policies can be combined with tax-preferred savings accounts if they meet certain IRS standards. And some preventive services can be covered first dollar without being subject to this deductible. The federally qualified standards, so if you want to have one of these tax-free health savings accounts to accompany your consumer-driven health plan, your insurance policy, your high-deductible policy, has to meet certain federal standards. The lowest deductible that can be charged, annual deductible, is $1,100 per person, $2,200 per family. This year, those amounts are indexed each year, so they increase. Preventive care can be covered first dollar, and prenatal care can be covered first dollar, so it doesn't need to be subject to the deductible, although none of the plans that we looked at had that. They did let well baby care and other mammograms and things like that be covered without being subject to the deductible, but none of the policies we looked at allowed that for prenatal care. I don't know, maybe Tom could comment on whether that's an industry trend, but we were just kind of surprised to see that. The maximum out-of-pocket limit on cost sharing under these plans, again, to be qualified to have a tax-free health savings account, is $5,500 per person, $11,000 for family coverage. That maximum only applies to in-network covered benefits, so there can be higher out-of-pocket maximums if you go out-of-network or no limit. Another important thing to know about these tax-qualified CDHPs is that there's no such thing as a per-person deductible in a family policy. When I was pregnant and I had family coverage, I only needed to satisfy my deductible for me, and then the rest of my maternity care could be reimbursed by my plan. But under tax-qualified CDHPs, if there's a family policy, you forget about the single person. The family deductible and the family out-of-pocket limit is what needs to be covered, even if only one person is making claims. And under some policies, I talked about your pregnancy might start in 1 year and end in the next year. Under traditional policies, sometimes you can credit last year's expenditures toward this year's deductible, but that's also not allowed under these federally tax-qualified plans. Those are pretty much the IRS standards. The IRS doesn't say what has to be covered, just whatever is covered has to be subject to these cost-sharing limits. And then the IRS also puts a limit on how much you can contribute in any given year, to your tax-preferred health savings account. And that limit is your deductible or, I didn't write it down, I think it's $2,600 per person. Employers or individuals or a combination can contribute to these accounts, and the average employer contribution is about $1,600 per year. So with all of that, what we did was we took came up actually with our own estimate. We were working on this study while the Thompson folks were doing their analysis. So we constructed a cost analysis of what it costs to have a baby. To do this, we took published practice guidelines that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists have developed for what care you need during a routine pregnancy, and we kind of came up with a little shopping list. You need a certain number of prenatal visits and a sonogram and lab tests and stuff like that. And then we took that shopping list and we matched it with billed and allowed charges for those services that we obtained through a claim sample that was provided to us by the Maryland Health Insurance Plan, which is a state high-risk pool in this area, which tries to pay claims at approximately the same rate as commercial carriers. So then that's how we kind of costed out a baby. And then when we had a shopping list and a price attached to it, we compared that to a list of plans. A traditional health plan that we identified that seemed to line up with what the typical or average employer-sponsored plan is, and then 12 different consumer-driven health plans. And we just sort of lined them up and looked at what was covered and looked at how the coverage worked to try to see how would these plans cover the cost of maternity care. These are the cost estimates of pregnancy that we came up with using this MHIP data, and as you'll see, it's in the same general ballpark as the numbers that Stella gave to you based on her database. And then, because pregnancies can vary, just like health plans can vary, we came up with three different pregnancy scenarios. So the first was kind of a best case. We have a very simple pregnancy, no complications, vaginal delivery. All care begins and ends in one plan year, and all care is in-network. And the family begins with family coverage, so we didn't have to try to figure out when that jump between individual to family coverage actually occurs. In the second scenario, probably a little more likely for what people might experience in real life, we looked at an uncomplication C-section delivery. We let the pregnancy cross two plan years, so your prenatal care is in 1 year and the delivery costs are in the second year. And in the second scenario, we let the anesthesiologist be out of network. I don't know if any of you had a baby, but I was happy for whoever came in the room to take care of me when it was time for my epidural. And oftentimes, you don't have the luxury of picking an anesthesiologist who's in network. And then in the third scenario, this was really the worst case scenario, so not one that we would expect to happen most of the time, but certainly the worst case is the reason why people buy health insurance. So we had a complicated pregnancy where the mother had extensive preterm labor, hospitalization care to stop premature labor. In the first plan year, the baby was born in the second plan year, a low birth weight and needed to be in the neonatal intensive care unit. Again, all care was in network and family coverage. So, and then we lined those scenarios up with different health plans. The health plans are not meant to be particularly representative of anything. We just picked a bunch of plans. To do this, we reached out to insurance agents or brokers who we knew in Maryland and in North Carolina and in California, and asked them to send us consumer-driven health plans that they themselves market and are aware of that are sold by major insurance carriers with major market share in those states and also by insurance companies that sort of specialize in the CDHP product. And we compared those with a traditional plan. The CDHP plans that we looked at were sold in the small group market and in the individual market. There were a dozen in all. I just have a couple of them up here. And we compared those with a traditional health plan that is available to federal employees and the FEHBP plan and also one consumer-driven health plan that's available through the FEHBP. And as you can see, the features of these policies vary a lot. The deductibles go from $3,000 for a family up to $10,000 for a family. The out-of-pocket limit from $8,000 up to $15,000. Plan B that we picked was the most generous coverage for maternity care of all the CDHPs because no cost sharing accrues after the deductible, unlike other medical care services. So we lined them up against the costs in these scenarios. So here's the first scenario. The total allowed charges for care would be just under $10,000 in this scenario. And as you can see, the traditional health plan covers most of the costs, leaving the family out of pocket with just under $1,500. And then the out of pocket charges that the family would face increase with the consumer-driven health plans. And with Plan B, you've got the most generous coverage, and with Plan K, the least generous coverage out of all of the 12 that we looked at. I'm very sorry. I thought I had turned this off. So sorry. Okay, so that was scenario one. Under scenario two, the costs get a little higher because the pregnancy is more expensive and also because cost sharing can accrue over two plan years. And so, again, you see the traditional plan covers about 18% of the costs, whereas the CDHP with the most expensive cost sharing requires the family to pay about 80% of the total costs. And then finally, under scenario C, now we start hitting our out-of-pocket limits in 2 years. Under the traditional plan, the family could be on the hook for close to $9,000. Interestingly, the Plan B, which is the most generous consumer-driven health plan, offers more comprehensive coverage than this because, again, you only have to hit under this plan the deductible. No additional out-of-pocket expenses are required of the family after that for care related to pregnancy. But as you go up the list, you could see that families could be liable for $15,000, $20,000, $22,000 of the cost of care. Just to give you some context for that. There was some research published about a year and a half ago on medical bankruptcies showing what kinds of medical bills bankrupt families, and the average out-of-pocket medical expenses for families that had to declare bankruptcy was on the order of about $14,000. So you really could be getting into the stratosphere with some of these plans that require the most expensive cost sharing. In summary, I think what we found, it may not be a very surprising finding, is that the financial liability for families for maternity care under consumer-driven health plans is much higher relative to traditional insurance. And while people can save up against these potential financial liabilities through tax-qualified HSAs, it could take you several years to save that amount of money under the IRS limits, and then you would wipe out your savings in 1 year with an expensive maternity care event. The financial consequences of health insurance complexity, though, I think were important in all of the plans that we looked at. It's just that the stakes are higher under consumer-driven health plans because the numbers are so much higher. So if you're not sure going into your claims-making process which claims count toward the deductible, that's one thing if your deductible is $500. It's another thing if your deductible is $5,000. Do these plans put consumers in the driver's seat? Maybe, but it can be an expensive ride. And I think people need a better roadmap to understand what their costs might be. At a minimum, if there was less variation in health insurance generally, then people could make safer assumptions about how their health insurance works. So we could have standard rules about when coverage takes effect for newborns, or whether the deductible applies to the out-of-pocket maximum, or how out-of-network cost sharing will accrue and be limited, or when complications of pregnancy could be covered. We don't have anything like standardization in that. It varies all over the place, and it can be hard for people to find out until they're actually in the situation. And then it's too late to make a change. In addition, I think for consumers to be in the driver's seat, it would be helpful if health plans could also construct scenarios like this and sort of lay out there a typical pregnancy or a typical heart attack or a typical, you know, breast cancer episode, and just sort of give people an idea of what their expenses might be and then line that up with how their health plan might work, or even present some data on what share of costs their health plan tends to recognize and cover under some of these different health events. So to really be in the driver's seat, I think consumers could use better tools to understand the protection that health insurance provides and the financial consequences of the choices they make. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to start with Lisa and Tom to give some initial impressions to start off this discussion of these two reports. Tom, I have a feeling that you may be a little bit more in the hot seat this morning than Lisa. So I'm going to let you go first, Lisa, and Tom, you can think about what you want to say. And turn your mic on.
This reminded me. Well, Alina outed me earlier as the co-conspirator in the initial thinking about planning these reports, so I just wanted to start by commending the painstaking work by Stella and Karen and Mila and their colleagues. I think that's evident in the detail that when you have a chance to look through the detailed reports, and I think I suspect it's the kind of thing that when they started out to do it, they thought it was going to be a lot easier than it turned out to be, so I'm glad they stuck with it and gave us the information we have seen today. I think in terms of key messages here, one of them is, well, maternity care is expensive. We're all paying for it through the health insurance premiums that we're contributing, through our tax dollars, as was noted. Medicaid is a big funder of maternity care. But clearly, for people who have no health insurance, this is potentially a very burdensome expense. I know from my friends at the March of Dimes that of the 45 million uninsured Americans, 28% are women of childbearing age. That's between 12 and 13 million women. Happily, as Jennifer House noted earlier, Medicaid does come in and provide a safety net for many of those women if they do become pregnant, but that's not true for all of them. There are holes in that safety net, and this is a very significant expense. I think it's worth noting that the figures that Stella shared with you are the total amount that would be paid by somebody who's covered under a large employer plan. So that reflects discounts that large employers tend to get, and often people who have no health insurance don't benefit from that and end up paying a lot more. And I think, correct me, Stella, if I'm wrong, but I think in their detailed analysis, they show total charges that are almost twice as high. So the $8,800 average figure is closer to $17,000 if somebody had to pay sort of list price as we think about it. And then we know there are women that don't show up in the 45 million uninsured because they have health insurance, but unfortunately they don't happen to have health insurance that covers maternity care, so they're in the same situation, really, of having to potentially pay all these costs out of pocket. I think in her detailed report, Karen gets into cases that they're interesting where plans don't typically cover prenatal care and delivery, but if there are complications during the pregnancy, some of those costs would be covered, but it's hard to know when that would be, and it varies case by case almost even within a plan. And then a final point on the on just the expense of this is what we learned from Karen's report is even if you're in the best situation, which is that you have health insurance and it covers maternity care, there's just wide variability in what expenses you might end up facing depending on the details of the coverage that you have. I thought it was striking not only within the high deductible plans that she looked at, but she has a comparator, a traditional health plan that's a large employer plan that showed that your out-of-pocket costs for the healthy pregnancy case would be around 15% of the total. In Stella's data, it was much lower than that. It was 5%. So I think that shows that even among the traditional plans, there's a lot of variability in someone's out-of-pocket costs. I think Diane Rowland in the beginning kind of reminded us, and it's worth circling back to, the population we're talking about here, young and healthy people who aren't used to having a lot of medical expenses and in some cases aren't planning on having maternity medical expenses. And so I think we need to remember those
cases too. In some ways, a planned pregnancy is really kind of the ideal application of a consumer-directed health plan because you're planning it, you're thinking about it, you can choose a health plan that makes sense for having to face maternity coverage. You can think about what providers you want to go to based on what the cost might be, as well as whether you hear that there are high-quality providers. You choose maybe what hospital you deliver at based on that. But I think one of the other messages here, there are still a lot of uncertainties. Even in the best plan or in the best planned case can end up, unfortunately, with complications of pregnancy, in which all the decisions that you've made up to that point turn out to be not the best decisions. Had you known what was going to happen, you could, in the case of a preterm labor, for example, you might need to deliver in a hospital that has the best neonatal intensive care facilities for the baby, and that might not be the hospital you were planning on delivering at. So for all those reasons, I think it's important to have these issues out there and this information out there, and I think it'll be helpful to consumers, and I think there are things here for policymakers to think about as well.
Thank you, Lisa. Tom Wilder?
Thank you, and I want to thank the Kaiser Family Foundation and the March of Dimes for the opportunity to be here today and participate in this important discussion, and also pass along to you apologies and regrets from Jeff Lemieux, who was scheduled to be here today, but because of an emergency, asked me to fill in. I think that the two studies that we've heard about today really highlight the financial challenges that families face when there is a pregnancy, and also highlight the key importance of insurance in helping cover those costs. And as you can see from the two studies, there's a variety of approaches that employers are taking to actually provide that coverage, whether it's a high deductible plan that's got a health savings account or a health reimbursement arrangement with it, or a more traditional coverage. And there's really no one-size-fit-all. There's a variety of approaches. And I think particularly the study that the Kaiser Family Foundation did really helps us understand better what those measures are you need to look at with consumer-directed care. What are the out-of-pocket expenses that a family may face? And they highlighted a number of the issues, but I'll just touch on them. I think obviously you're looking at the deductible, which is the amount that you're going to have to pay before the insurance is available. We've done a study over the past 3 years, a pretty comprehensive survey of the HSA market, and our survey is showing that the average deductible in the small group market for an HSA is around $4,500. The average deductible in the large group market is around $3,900. And then in terms of the out-of-pocket limit, which is the most that you have to pay in one plan year, the average is around $6,800 for employer-sponsored coverage. And even within those out-of-pocket and deductible limits, you need to really think about what is or is not covered by the insurance before or in spite of having out-of-pocket. So as mentioned by Karen, there is coverage for prenatal and other services as a preventive benefit first dollar. Unfortunately, we have not specifically keyed in on what kind of preventive services are covered by health insurance plans, although that is an issue we're taking a look at. But we do know that over 90% of the plans that responded to our survey do cover at least some level of preventive benefits before the deductible has to be met. And even within those coverages, there's a lot of ancillary services that the health insurance plan may typically cover. We know that most plans cover disease management, for example, for things like diabetes. So there are other services that are available to you free of charge that will help with some of these costs. And I think it's very important to look at the premiums. As was emphasized, the premiums for consumer-directed products, because there's a higher deductible, premiums are frequently lower. Again, in looking at our survey from this last year, the premiums in the group market for a HSA-compatible high-deductible health plan are around 39% lower than a comparable product. So to the extent that there are lower premiums, of course, that's less of a cost that you're going to have coming out of your paycheck. And we know also that, as was pointed out, that when you've got these accounts, you do have employers contributing to them. As the Kaiser study highlights, about two-thirds of employers put money into the accounts, and that average amount is around $1,600. That survey information is confirmed by some of the anecdotal evidence we're hearing from our plans that, again, a number of employers are funding these accounts, or if they're not funding the accounts, they are drastically lowering the premiums or having zero premiums in some cases to kind of make up the difference. So there is other money that's available in that account that will build up over time to help with the costs. And, again, this is early evidence. We do know that actually some of these consumer-directed products are actually helping people get coverage for the first time. Again, back to our survey, we know that around 27% of the enrollees in the individual market never had insurance before. And in terms of the small group market, around 33% of the small employers never previously offered coverage to their employees. So although these do have higher deductibles, these policies are giving people at least a segment of the population the opportunity the first time to actually have insurance coverage as opposed to being uninsured. And we do know, and again, this is very early evidence, we do know that folks who are in consumer-directed plans, because they do have a portion of the cost that is their responsibility, whether it's from an account that's funded by the employer or out of pocket, that they are actually more engaged in their health care. We know that they are talking to their providers about procedures and treatments. We know that they are more aware of what their prescription drug costs are. We know that they are more frequently accessing online tools that plans are providing in terms of costs and quality of care. So what the future may hold, I think, is still an open question, but I think they are, at least the early evidence, having a better conversation with their healthcare provider about the kinds of care that's being delivered, about the ultimate cost of that care. I think the final point I'd make, and this was highlighted by several of the panelists, I think all of us really need to be more aware of these kinds of costs. And I think the March of Dimes study does a very good job of kind of laying out the kind of costs that people face. I think all of us really need to be more aware of what insurance is available to you and what is covered under that policy or how that policy is structured. So I think both of these studies have done a very good job of really highlighting a number of the issues that all of us need to kind of take a look at.
Thank you, Tom. I have one quick follow-up for you. You said that your association is taking a look at some of the coverage issues related to preventive services for pregnant women, I presume. What does that entail, that look, and what could the consequence of such a study be?
We actually are in the process of looking at a survey of preventive benefits across the board to get a better understanding of what preventive benefits are covered before the deductible. In essence, what preventive benefits are covered first dollar under HSA products. But it's still in the very early stages. We have not even put the survey out in the field yet. So we're trying to get a better sense of what is under the deductible.
Mila Kaufman, I'd like to turn to you now. As Karen said, you had the Herculean task of reviewing a lot of the plans. Pardon me. And you come to the conclusion that one route is to have greater standardization among the plans. What do you mean by that, and what drove you to that conclusion, having reviewed all of them?
And it was really fun.
Right.
A number of things. One, well, first of all, they're not written in English. Second of all, the policies varied so greatly in how they worked, what counted towards the deductible, what didn't, what kind of out-of-pocket expenses one may face. Even policies sold by the same insurance company in the same market had very different rules. So if you know how your policy works today, tomorrow's policy may work very differently. The summaries of the policies did not reflect accurately what was covered and when it was covered, so you actually had to look at the policies. The policies were between 80 pages, I think was the shortest we found, and some of them were about 160 pages. And like I said, they were really not written in English. There were lots of vague provisions, so you couldn't really figure out what was a complication in some of the policies, what was included in prenatal care. And so we concluded that if consumers are expected to be more informed and make more informed choices and be more deliberate about how we spend our healthcare dollars, one of the underlying assumptions there is that we actually can understand how our coverage works. And to do that, we really have to look at rules and standards for coverage, that private coverage that's sold there, to simplify things.
What do you think of that idea, Tom?
I think it's important to perhaps have a standard set of questions that you can measure your policy against. I think having a standard set of answers is a mistake. We know there's a large variety of employers. There's a large variety of needs that people have. So I think the assumption that there's this one kind of universal policy that's good for everybody, I'm not sure I necessarily would follow that.
I know we don't have a lot of time this morning, so I do want to open it up to the audience. Tiffany has the mic. Just raise your hand, stand up, identify yourself and your affiliation and who you're asking the question of. The gentleman in the back.
Hi, I'm Chris Lee. I'm with the Washington Post. This question would be for Karen Politz, I guess, or Mila Kaufman, or both. I love all the data. I feel a little bit like someone who's staring at the long list of the policy and trying to figure out what it says. Are you all would you all say then, based on your research, that if you're considering having a baby, you shouldn't enroll in a high deductible plan unless you have no other option?
Actually, there was a study done recently, I think by the Government Accountability Office, that included some data collected from focus groups of people who had been enrolled in these, and they said, overwhelmingly, if you are contemplating having a baby or having any kind of a big health event, this is not the policy for you.
And you agree?
Absolutely.
Lisa, do you want to jump in on that? Turn your mic on.
Well, I wasn't familiar with the GAO study, but I certainly think that you have to let people who've had the experience speak for themselves. I think, you know, the point that Tom made earlier is that often this is the only option available to people, so you either have no health insurance coverage or a high deductible plan, and, you know, I think that is a point. I think that it's unfortunate if we're in a circumstance, though, where the only choices people have is no coverage or coverage that doesn't meet their health care needs, and I would hope that we can do better than that.
And if I could just do a quick follow-up, that you sort of touched on my follow-up, which is, most of these high deductible plans you looked at are in the small group or individual market, and as Tom Wilder pointed out, and you just did too, often those people have a choice of that or nothing. So to what extent is this whole study not really about consumer-directed plans, but about, is it really just a proxy for studying employer-provided insurance for people who don't really have employer-provided insurance, and we've known for a long time that one is a lot more generous than the other?
Well, we actually, when we were comparing, if you look in the study, you can see the data on all 12 of the plans that we looked at. And in the slides that I put up and in the summary slides, we just featured one individual plan because, by and large, the individual plans didn't cover maternity care at all. So the numbers were just sort of so awful that it felt like we couldn't sort of lay those out there against the other policies and, you know, leave the impression that it was even worse than it is. So I think in the individual market, it almost doesn't matter, consumer-driven, low deductible. This is just not a market that covers maternity care very well. And if you need maternity care services, that is, if you're pregnant, you will be turned down every time in the underwritten individual market. So I think it's a very difficult healthcare event to insure against if you are out there on your own buying coverage. The plans, in most states, the plans will sell a separate sort of addition to the policy that covers maternity care. But those are very expensive. They will often double your premium and then have other restrictions on them. The coverage won't kick in for several years. There are additional high deductibles that accrue and stuff like that.
I think going back to your original question, it's not so much is it a good choice or not. It's what questions you need to ask when you evaluate any kind of policy. So, for example, when you evaluate a high deductible health plan, yes, you need to look at the deductible. You need to look at the out-of-pocket limit. You need to look what the premium is versus other coverage that may be available to you. You need to look at whether or not, if it's an employer-sponsored plan, how much money is your employer going to put into the account. So I think there's this whole series of measures or questions that you really need to look at and not just say, you know, this approach is good or not good. It's what, you know, how do I evaluate my various options?
Alina?
Yeah, and I'd like, I'd like to add to that because I think that people do need to be prepared to spend a lot of money when they enroll in a high deductible plan, and probably higher than the deductible, and I think it's important to look at also the out-of-pocket limits. And also the other important consideration is that you could be a very healthy young woman and have an extremely complicated pregnancy. So this is a very difficult issue to predict ahead of time. You know, one of my colleagues at Kaiser has very healthy young woman, has gestational diabetes. She just commented that she got a $900 bill that the insurance didn't cover for counseling and other monitoring services. She couldn't have known this ahead of time that she even had this. I'm sure, you know, they will appeal and I'm sure they'll work it out. But, you know, this is just very hard to predict. And so if you go in there, you really need to go in with your eyes open and recognize that you could be paying a lot. And even with the tax benefits for a lot of the low-income families, and we saw the statistics there, accruing this much amount of money for a young family is very difficult to do.
I'd like to ask a follow-up, jumping off with the issue that you raised, Anne. If you step back from this issue, addressing it instead as how it impacts individuals, and let's look at how it affects the nation's healthcare system, what is the better alternative when it comes to the health of the nation's healthcare system? For a woman to go into the hospital to give birth uninsured or to go in with a consumer-driven health plan that may have a lot of out-of-pocket costs?
Well, you know, that's such a great question because we've put ourselves in this box. You know, is a little bit of insurance better than nothing? You know, is a little bit of a seatbelt better than nothing if your car crashes? Is a little bit of a bulletproof vest better than nothing if you're in a wreck? I mean, health insurance, I think we've almost lost sight of what this is. This isn't like shoes or oranges. You know, I'll get half a dozen because I can't afford a dozen this week. This is protection that we're buying. And the data on bankruptcy is really telling. Medical bills are the leading reason why families declare bankruptcy in the United States, and most of those filers had insurance. So being underinsured isn't that different from being uninsured. And I think, contrary to all of our logic about compromise and, you know, incrementalism and let's get a little bit better, we've put ourselves in this position where the best we can do in some cases is to give people inadequate health insurance. And we're not giving it to them, by the way. They have to pay for it. So you pay for the privilege of having coverage that could leave you in a big financial bind. And lest we think this is just financial, when your insurance doesn't cover healthcare services, sometimes you have trouble getting to those healthcare services. So you delay getting services. You can't get to them when you need to, or you can't get the best care that you would otherwise get because they won't take you if you can't promise how you're going to pay. So I think this question about is something better than nothing, and health insurance has led us into maybe the development of this market, and it probably isn't a good thing for our healthcare system. It leaves people thinking they have protection when they don't, and it leaves us with a false sense of security that somehow we can get by without answering the bigger question, which is how can we in this great nation make sure that everybody has good health insurance?
Tom?
And I guess my kind of observation would be if I'm a family and I have no insurance and I'm faced with a $20,000 hospital bill from a complicated pregnancy, that's my $20,000 out-of-pocket. If I have a high-deductible health plan, you know, my average out-of-pocket is going to be around $6,800, not even counting what other preventive or other services may have been covered first dollar. So I understand the concern about some of the financial pressures, but I guess I'd rather take the $6,800 out-of-pocket as opposed to the $20,000 out-of-pocket.
There's a question up here. Yes. Wait for the mic.
I'm Joanne Howes with DDB Issues and Advocacy. I wanted to ask Karen, if you were able to look at all at this concept of consumer-driven healthcare, and were people in pregnancy able, making those kinds of decisions about picking doctors, healthcare providers, et cetera, based upon good cost value? I mean, can we look, have you, were you able to look at that, or was this all just about really?
One of the things that I think these plans try to do and are doing increasingly, and Tom could speak to this better than I, is they are trying to make information available to people about the charges, for example, that different providers will charge, so that you can get a better sense. I'm not sure if, you know, the average person who's never been pregnant before has any idea sort of what the vast array of charges are out there that they could face. And it's not just the doctors. You know, the difference between billed and allowed charges for doctors was about 2-to-1 laboratories. Don't even talk to me about labs. It's like 5-to-1. So, you know, you get this bill for $200 and the insurance company recognizes 40 of it. And you just have to wonder, where's the rest of it going? So I think plans are trying to make more information available, and hopefully that will force a little more standardization of charges out there, because I just can't believe it, blood tests cost that many different prices, you know, in the universe. I think they also, though, you know, price shopping for medical care is not probably the most important thing on a lot of people's minds. You want a really good doctor. And the quality information, I think, is less developed. I think it's less developed generally. This is a harder thing for us to measure. We interviewed medical directors at some of these plans and asked them about that, and they said, it's just not good. And it may not be good for a very long time. And it's also very hard for plans to invest in quality research for their members, because people turn over, so there's not kind of a lot of payoff for them in making this available. So, I think there are good things about trying to make people more aware about how the healthcare system works, because if for no other reason, maybe we won't put up with the way it works too much longer. But I think there is absolutely a limit to how much consumers, particularly when they're in need of healthcare, can be expected to go out and obtain and process all this information and make rational market solutions when they may be sick or in pain or in labor.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's important for all consumers to be more engaged in talking to their doctors and getting a better understanding of what their options are and some of the consequences of those options. My wife's a nurse, and so every time I go in to see a doctor, she gives me this long list of questions to ask and berates me if I don't ask all the questions on the list. And I think plans are trying to do a much better job of gathering the information and sharing it with consumers and getting them more engaged. And I appreciate that these are really complicated issues, but I would also add that I think consumers are a lot smarter than sometimes we give them credit for.
There was an article in the Wall Street Journal today about consumer-driven health plans and about relatively low consumer satisfaction in some quarters. But what it said was where they had high degrees of success was where companies took several months to explain the complexities of these plans and accompanied those explanations with a package of good financial incentives.
Yeah, I the satisfaction rates are interesting, and I think part of it is this is really for people that are in a high deductible plan for the first time. It's really a different way of having their healthcare financed. So I think it's a new pattern. It takes people a while to get used to that pattern. But I also think it does point out, as the discussions here pointed out, the importance of really, no matter what the product is, really educating people about what they have and what it is and what it is not, and really getting, again, consumers more engaged in the discussion.
I think we have time for two more questions up here. Oh, sorry, over there, and then you. Okay. Sorry about that.
Good morning. I'm Natani Singleton with Planned Parenthood Federation of America, and I was wondering if any of you have looked at the cost or availability of midwifery care, either under the consumer-driven plans or traditional plans.
I think
in our study to the extent that it was covered by the employer-sponsored insurance, and we do have some plans that do cover that, that was incorporated into our costs, but we did not break that out separately.
Yes, up here.
Hi, I'm Ashley Waters with the National Business Group on Health, and I gather that the CDHPs analyzed here did not include the prenatal care as a preventative service at first dollar. And I'm wondering if you could speculate if those were covered at first dollar as a preventative service and not applied to the deductible, how would these compare cost sharing wise to the traditional plan?
In the analysis that we looked at, it would have mattered more in the pregnancies that span 2 years. Most of the charges that are associated with maternity care happen at or after delivery. So the obstetrician typically bills one fee, which includes all of the prenatal visits and the delivery. The anesthesia care obviously happens in the delivery room. The hospital stays for delivery. So the prenatal care services that we looked at that would happen first, you know, separate from that, would be for your sonogram, your lab tests, your initial prenatal care visit. That's usually billed separately from the other eight. So, and they averaged, in the report, it was like $500 or $600 in allowed charges and about twice that in billed charges.
Karen or Mila, the report said you were not able to estimate tax savings that individuals might get from these plans. If you had been able to, would it have changed the bottom lines very much?
It's the savings for any individual would be very individualized. So the most that you could put in under any of these plans would have been either the deductible or the maximum IRS limit, which I think is about $2,200 a year for an individual, twice that for a family. So you could certainly offset these out-of-pocket costs with the savings that you had put into your tax-free health savings account, and you could calculate in the health benefits of that. Interestingly, this same GAO study that looked at the early year experience of these HSA-related high-deductible health plans showed that the people who open these plans and these health savings accounts tend to be very wealthy. And they use these savings accounts as tax-free savings accounts. It's like having a second IRA. And when they make claims, they don't take it out of their health savings account. They pay cash. Because why would you take money out that can continue to earn tax-free interest? And actually, we have another colleague at Georgetown who's in one of these plans, and her husband's in a law firm, and they, you know, she does their taxes, and she says, oh, yeah, you know, when it's time to take my kids to the doctor or somebody gets sick, we pay cash. We don't take it out of our HSA. So it's sort of there, but I think for a modest income family, after you've paid the premiums, and remember, most of the premium savings for group plans accrue to the employer, not to the individual. You've already had to pay for the premium. You still have to pay for these plans, and you can put away money tax-free, but it could take you quite a few years to save up this kind of money, particularly if you had a very complicated pregnancy.
Okay. I think we have time for one more question. Yes. I think it's appropriate I called on a pregnant lady as the last question.
My name is Cornelia Kelly, and I'm here as, I guess, a consumer of health insurance. And also, I'm a member of an organization called Birth Options Alliance, which is based out of Tacoma Park. And I think in follow-up to your question about the care of midwifery, my question is, it seems to me there's a pretty big gap in regarding the costs of healthcare and doctors and hospitals. I guess in information, really, studies done comparing the difference in costs between hospital-based care versus certified nurse midwives. Just to give you an example, you know, because since my second child is due in October, I called around to check the difference in costs between a hospital stay versus a home delivery or birth center stay. And a hospital delivery, I mean, you've got many numbers up here. At Shady Grove Adventist Hospital, for example, 48 hours vaginal natural delivery, $7,000. And that doesn't include the doctor. That doesn't include any professionals. However, at a birth center cost, the birth center in Annapolis, the facility fee is $1,800. My question is, why has this not been examined? And it also seems to me that one of the big problems is lack of awareness, lack of education of women's options. And so that's my question. Why is there not more of an effort, I guess, to educate women about their alternatives to obstetrical, the obstetrical model, or options for out-of-hospital deliveries? Thank you.
Mila, do you want to go?
Sure. I can just tell you what we noticed in the policies we looked at. There was no difference in terms of the types of providers that were covered under consumer-driven health plans versus traditional plans. And I'm assuming that the types of providers that are covered and you can get reimbursement for, a lot of times depends on what the state laws say about scope of medical practice and who's authorized to provide types of medical services. But the bottom line is we did not find consumer-driven health plans excluded certain providers compared to traditional plans. They were pretty much the same in the types of providers they covered.
You know, and the other thing I might add, which I thought was just amazing, if you think about the fact that one-third of all births are C-sections, and, you know, kind of where we've come to, you know, it's kind of where we kind of accept that fact. We accept that it's, you know, $4,000 more expensive without kind of offering women. We're moving the other way rather quickly, away from birth centers. And I think that we have this feeling that, you know, that we want to have, you know, the high tech is the best way to go and, a lower cost option. And maybe this is something that the plans could offer information about birth centers as other options. But that, you know, really that is really an important issue. But the healthcare delivery system seems to be going quite the other way. You're absolutely right.
I think probably the context for your question was the two birthing centers in the Tacoma Park area are closing down, right? Yep. They're gone? Okay. Thank you all. I think all of the panelists will stay for a few minutes to answer any follow-up questions, and I'm going to give the final word to Alina.
I just want to thank you all for coming and thank this fabulous panel. I think we've had a great discussion. This is an issue that the Kaiser Family Foundation really their Women Health Policy Program, we try to focus on health policy issues of importance to women. Clearly, this is a very important one, really shaping not only how we're paying for care now, but thinking about as states and the federal government, we're looking at expanding options for the uninsured. I think these are important considerations that will hopefully inform the debate as we move forward to hopefully solving the problem of the uninsured and health care costs. So thank you.